This is the Medicast, April 2nd, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 60. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I want to thank all of you for picking up this show. For those of you that are brand new listeners to the program, welcome to the Medicast. This is it. You can check out the show here. You can check out the other episodes over at the iTunes store and also on the website at www.medicast.com. Check out a bunch of the episodes, check out the website, and get a sense of what the Medicast is all about. And, of course, for all of you long-term listeners, I want to thank you all for contributing to the show with your comments and questions here and over at the website. We've had a lot of great discussions recently going on about all kinds of issues, from delousing an ambulance to dealing with some issues on the stem cell debate, all of that and a whole lot more over at the Medicast website. So head on over there if you haven't been recently and check out some of the things we've been talking about. But today we got the podcast, and I'm really excited. We've got a lot to do in this show. I have an interview coming up later on in this episode with Doug Wolfberg from Page Wolfberg and Worth, and he's responding to a couple of questions I had that came my way by way of one of the listeners about whether it really is cost-effective to have separate provider malpractice insurance, and also some questions about what to do when you're involved in a lawsuit, perhaps involving your practice of medicine as a paramedic or EMT in the field. So stay tuned for that. That'll be coming up here a little bit later. But first, a few items from listener mail, some things that came into me by way of email. First of all, I got an interesting email from listener Henry. He is the younger brother of our good friend With, who is the blogger over at iHeartEMS.com or iHeartEMS.blogspot.com, to be more correct. She has a great EMS blog over there. And Henry had a question about how old you have to be an EMS provider. And this is one of those sticky situations because it varies from state to state, and I assume worldwide from country to country. Here in the state of Maryland, you can get your EMT at the age of 16. Well, 16 in like 3 or 4 months, however long it takes you to get through the class. You can't start the class till you're 16. And I know in other areas, and including in the area where Henry is from, he has to be 18 before he can become an EMT. So I know this is an issue. I'd love to hear back from some others of you. You can shoot me an email and let me know what the ages are in your area to become an EMT or a paramedic. And I would love to hear back from you. So shoot me an email over at podmedic@mac.com, and maybe we can get some more information for Henry. I already responded to his email, but it raises some questions about how old you think people should be. 16 is a young age for some. Others are very mature at the age of 16. So it's an interesting point, and I wonder how you deal with that in your area. Another listener email I got had to do with a new listener, and this is from listener Raphael. And Raphael is an EMT student in Santa Barbara, California. And first of all, Raphael, good luck to you with your studies. I hope the Medicast helps you out. And he was wondering if I could do a little more on the National Registry skills. I will be adding more information on both the BLS and the ALS National Registry skill sheets and some of my take on what you can do to help you pass those particular skill stations. But I have to kind of spread that information out with the other tips and tricks that I include in the podcast, because some of you are students and some of you aren't. So I will try to continue to add to the list of National Registry skill sheets that I've covered, and hopefully If you have one you'd really like me to cover, send me an email and let me know about it, and I'll try to make that the next one. But I'm probably going to limit that, at least in the near future, to one or maybe two a month. So just keep in touch, Raphael, and again, good luck to you and your classmates in their class. Finally, this next and last item of listener mail comes in from our good friend Rick Rosati. And Rick is helping me line up a speaker for the next Medicast Live. You can reach that at medicastlive.com or head on over to talkshoe.com and sign up for a free account over there so you're ready for the next Medicast Live. What is the Medicast Live? Well, it's a monthly special episode of the Medicast that I produce over at a site called talkshoe.com. And at TalkShoe, it allows me to run my podcast, but also involve you, the listener, directly in the podcast. So there's a chat client that's part of that program, as well as a direct call-in feature. And it allows you to talk with me, to talk with the other podcasters that I invite to join me on the show. And this next one will be covering stroke and what it takes to become a stroke center for hospitals and how EMS can contribute to that. And I'm hoping to have at least one, if not two, representatives from local stroke centers on board. And Rick Rosati is helping me to line one of those individuals up. So as we get a little bit closer, I'll have some more info on that over at the website. But that's coming up on April 10th. That's a Tuesday night at 10 p.m. And you can listen in live to the Medicast. You can call in live to the Medicast. And we'd really like to hear all of your comments and questions for ourselves, the other podcasters, and our special guests on our topic. And this month, it'll be the topic of stroke. So, Rick, I want to thank you for helping out with that. Well, without any more uproar or fanfare, it's time to jump right on into this week's Medicast news. First off, I'm going to lead off with an item that is kind of good news, but also something to make us all a little bit wary. It's getting to be warm here in parts of the U.S., and it's going to get warmer as we head on into summertime. And that means that we're going to have everybody's backyard pools opening up, and unfortunately, we're going to have to start dealing with drowning victims or near-drowning victims and exactly what we can do about that. One of the things we can do is teach CPR in our communities. You guys know I'm a big advocate of that. The story I found comes from a child who was 17 months old and was wandering around in his backyard, somehow got through the gate, and family members found him lying face down in the pool, floating in the water. The grandmother that found him thought that he might be in the water for a few minutes. She jumped in and rescued him. She came out and began using the rescue skills that she used to teach as a Girl Scout den mother, and she was able to work on some of the CPR skills she used. EMTs arrived, put the young boy into an ambulance, and she heard him crying and just realized that she never thought she'd ever hear him cry again when she found him floating in the pool. So this is a reminder for all of us to get out in our communities and teach CPR and get it done. Go out to church groups, go out to community groups, start looking around for ways that you can talk about pool safety. Contact your local Red Cross or your local YMCA. See if they want to work out some kind of a cross promotion so that the two of you groups can go out there and really hammer the idea and thought of pool safety and education in CPR. It's a really important subject. Okay, so you're riding along in your ambulance, you get to the scene that you've been called to, and you jump out and grab your gear bag and your heart monitor and your M16, and wait a minute, did I just say M16? I must be talking about Baghdad, right? Well, actually, no, I'm not. I've talked a lot about Baghdad EMS in the past, but I'm talking about Rio de Janeiro. Antonio Carlos Maya is an EMT with the military police unit in Rio de Janeiro. And in Brazil, in the slums in Brazil, they run into so much gang violence and local militias that the military police ambulance services carry flak vests, they carry 9mm pistols and M16s, and they are constantly dodging gunfire while they pick up patients in need of transport to the hospital, and at the same time, they're exchanging gunfire with local gang members. This is such a big issue and what is considered to be an inextricable part of life in Rio's slums. Some debate whether it's appropriate to call this type of thing a war zone, but you know, if you're in the middle of it and bullets are flying and you're having to return fire, I guess war zone is based upon what you have going around you at the time. It really doesn't matter whether it's actually been declared a war. The Ambulance Corps, the Special Life-Saving and Rescue Group, was created in 1996 when 95 military police officers from Brazil were shot and killed in Rio. Since that time, things haven't improved. About 100 police officers are killed every year. So they have formed the ambulance service that goes out, and they have a four-man crew that waits four calls at a base, and they respond to try to recover and bring out the injured, ill, and the dead. So, you know, we think about how hard it is where we are. We think about those of us that work in inner city environments and maybe deal in some rough neighborhoods. You know, as bad as it gets here in the States in some of our inner city neighborhoods, I don't think it's ever quite that bad. None of us have ever felt the need to carry an M16 around with us, although some of us might want to. Anyway, check out the link to that story in the show notes. Well, speaking of violence and danger, this year's 2007 National EMS Memorial Service has been scheduled for May 26th in Roanoke, Virginia. The ceremony will begin at 7 p.m. at the First Baptist Church of Roanoke. And at that ceremony, the families of the fallen EMS personnel will be given a white rose and also receive a medallion with their provider's name and date of sacrifice, as well as an American flag that was flown over the U.S. Capitol. This memorial service is the 15th annual EMS memorial service, and it will wrap up a series of events surrounding EMS week in that town. Efforts are still underway down there to get the EMS memorial a permanent location, a permanent EMS memorial and museum in a setting where it can be displayed for the public to come and see more than just once a year. The EMS memorial, there are 334 EMS personnel that have been honored. Each person's name is engraved on a gold oak leaf, and it's hung on a tree. Last year, the leaves were displayed on a board, however, and it's because there is no permanent home for it. So if you're in that area and you have access to some resources, you're probably already very aware of this, but it's something we need to be aware of. As the time draws closer, I will feature in an episode a list of the 16 EMS providers who gave their ultimate sacrifice this year or in 2006, and we will share that with you, the listeners. Moving along, I know a lot of you are in school and a lot of you are students that listen to the Medicast. I wonder how much you all are paying for that education. Some of you might be lucky enough to live in an area where it doesn't cost you as much, or your local community helps support that education either in part or in total. Well, another area is starting to add that benefit. Ironwood, Michigan is beginning to offer a scholarship program because they are desperately in need of emergency medical technicians. And they're hoping that offering scholarships to help pay for the education will entice interested men and women to consider getting involved with that program. It's a 247-hour training course offered two nights a week that they will be offering as a free training program in the county. And they're hopeful that this will continue to increase recruiting efforts for the local EMS services. Instructors will be on the screen, and they will have classes via a a internet web link or a teleconference link where they will actually see instructors from the Marquette General Hospital. And that's kind of neat because they'll be able to take the course as a distance learning program, and it'll give them an opportunity to do so in a more convenient setting, at least not at a huge distance from their homes. What are your areas doing about things like this? If you're an EMS leader, what are you doing to try to get more free training services provided to your community so that you can continue to prime the pump so that we can get more EMS providers out on the streets? We are continuing to be at a loss and require more paramedics and EMTs than we currently have. And it's only going to get worse, folks, as more and more older EMS providers retire. We are going to need new, young, enthusiastic, and well-trained EMS providers to get out there and take their place. So do what you can in your community to make sure that people have an opportunity to get an education and do so in a way that is financially more available to them, because it's going to pay back the community. This is something that is really a no-brainer. You spend the money to get an EMT his education, that EMT will almost assuredly help save a life somewhere down the road. And, you know, for a couple $100, maybe $1,000, that is an inexpensive trade-off in my book. Finally, in the news, I found a study that discusses the necessity or the lack of necessity for non-emergent angioplasties. For a lot of you that might be in intra-facility transports, you may be dealing with patient questions about seeing an article like this, and I thought it was important for us to kind of go over it a little bit here and give you all the link at the website so you can head over and find a little bit more out about it yourself. The article has to do with a study that came out of the American College of Cardiology meeting recently, and the study was really kind of stunning to the community that it was presented to the cardiology community. You know, we take patients who are in the middle of an acute myocardial infarction, and we take them to the hospital and try to get them to the closest cath lab if possible, and get them treated by having them get an angioplasty where we can get in there and remove the clot in the best manner possible. And this study is not talking about emergency angioplasties, and that's important for us to let people know. This is talking about the routine angioplasties, the non-emergent angioplasties. So you got a patient that maybe has been having some controlled angina. They're stable in their treatment, and the doctor just wants to get in there and take a look at what's going on. They go ahead and do an angioplasty. They take a look at what's going on with the patient's heart muscle, and they decide that there's been some kind of a blockage. They go in there while they're in there for the angioplasty, and they go ahead and take steps to remove the clot, place a stent, use a balloon. There's all kinds of things they can do there. What is the surprise, and what this study is talking about, is that after 5 years following the treatment by angioplasty, compared to people who just got drug therapy, there is no significant difference between the two groups of patients, between the patients who had drug therapy and the patients who received the angioplasty, the non-emergent angioplasty. And what this means is we really don't need to perform such a dangerous, invasive procedure. Yes, it's done all the time, and there's less danger now than there was about it. But angioplasty is still threading a device up into a major vascular space and getting things right up into the heart, and can cause all kinds of problems with the heart muscle and with other body complications, strokes, and hemorrhaging, and everything else. And it's really, apparently, according to this study, not necessary when it's performed in a non-emergent setting. Like I said, it's really important for us to stay up on these studies and to really read carefully and understand them, because we will be called upon, especially in longer transports, to answer some questions about things like this. And while we can defer them on some of these things, we can explain to a patient in the middle of a major MI that there's a difference between the treatment for an emergency patient and the treatment for routine transport patients. And that's really a question best left to the doctor. But in an emergency setting, angioplasty still is very important and a vital treatment option. This study really focuses on the people that have non-emergent use of this particular procedure. And when compared to use of other medications and other treatment options like ACE inhibitors, beta blockers, nitrates, changing this person's diet, statin drugs, the use of things like aspirin or Plavix, all of these things can change the outcome on all of the cardiac supply arteries, all of the coronary arteries, and not just the single one that might be showing up as a blockage right then. And so this is really a broader treatment that's available, and I think drugs are the better choice before it becomes a full-blown MI. But once the MI is there, it looks like cardiac catheterization is still going to be the best bet. That's going to wrap up the news and bring us into the tip and trick section of the show this week. And actually, I'm going to be doing an interview in lieu of the tip and trick of the week and the med of the week so that we can discuss an issue that was brought to my attention by one of the listeners to the show. An EMT student who had just graduated was concerned and wondering if he needed his own liability insurance policy. We see the liability insurance and malpractice insurance, specifically for the EMS field, advertised all the time in journals like the Journal of Emergency Medical Services and the magazine Emergency Medical Services. And we've often wondered, is this something we really need? Well, I had a great opportunity to interview Doug Wolfberg from the law firm Page, Wolfberg & Worth. They bill themselves as the national EMS industry law firm. They are all EMS providers in their own right. And I had a chance to talk with Doug via a Skype interview where I talked with him over the phone about this particular issue and a few other things concerning lawsuits and EMS, as well as some new training opportunities and products that they offer from their law firm to help us become better compliant with things like documentation. So without further ado, I'm going to jump right on into the interview with Doug.
Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'm here with Doug Wolfberg from Page, Wolfberg & Worth, the EMS attorneys. And Doug, tell me a little bit about your background with regards to EMS.
Well, I started as a volunteer EMS provider back in 1978 and ran in the field pretty consistently for the next 15 or 20 years, and then worked as an EMS regional council administrator, worked for the state EMS council in Pennsylvania, then worked for the federal government in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services doing trauma and EMS planning, and then went to law school and now practice EMS law with Page, Wolfberg & Worth.
That's a pretty amazing career path there. How did you find all the time to do all of that?
Well, it's easy when you start when you're 4 years old. No, it's just something that I've sort of really been in all my professional life. I mean, I originally became an EMT when I was in high school in central Pennsylvania, and just stayed in the field and did it all through college, and just continued to work after law school or after a college in EMS, either in the field or administration, and then just decided I wanted to go to law school and did that route. So sort of left the career path and went to school full time, and then sort of jumped back into the career side of it. So it was just something I guess sort of kept that, I guess.
Well, that's great, and that makes you a perfect resource for the question that I got from a listener. I had a brand new EMTB student that was listening to my show, and they sent me a question that basically was they were starting to get information about malpractice insurance for an EMS provider, and they sent me the email, "Is this something I really need?" And I couldn't answer that question. I'm a volunteer, and I carry a personal liability rider on my homeowner's insurance, but I'm not even sure if that covers me. What can you say in answer to someone that asks you a question like, do I need EMS provider malpractice insurance?
Well, clearly the answer is yes. Now, the only real follow-up to that is where, you know, from where do you get that provided? In most cases, your organization will provide that. If your organization has malpractice or what we call professional liability coverage, that would extend, it should extend to any acts that the individual provider performs in the course and scope of their duties. So if they're performing their duties as an EMS field provider and commit an act of malpractice or negligence, then the agency's or the organization's professional liability insurance should cover liability both for the organization and for its individual agents, volunteers, employees, servants, whatever the case may be. So first and foremost, you know, you should really make sure that your organization is carrying professional liability. And ordinarily, that would cover most acts of negligence or malpractice committed by the volunteers, members, or employees of that agency, as long as they're acting in the course and scope of their employment or of their volunteer position.
But you have to you really need to go and just verify that everything's squared away on that front, I guess. And that would really be something that most agencies or every agency should have. I know my volunteer company carries a policy, and I know that my county EMS agency also carries a liability policy that covers specifically the ALS providers.
Right. I mean, it would be very important to check with your agency and certainly make sure that when you're acting on their behalf, that they've got coverage in place, whether that's professional liability, automobile liability, workers' comp, you know, all of those coverages really should be in place to protect the agency and its individual employees or volunteers. I think one of the other questions that sort of was raised by your question is whether or not people need individual liability protection on their own policies. And if that's something you'd like me to also address, I'd be happy to do that.
Absolutely. I think that's, I think that maybe, you know, do we need supplemental insurance or something on the side? Because I've seen it advertised in GEMS and EMS where you can get malpractice insurance or personal liability coverage. Is that something that's necessary also?
Well, whether or not it's necessary really depends on everybody's individual circumstances. You know, and our answer to that question is that individual liability, meaning liability on the part of an individual EMT, paramedic, or other, you know, EMS provider, where they end up having to pay a verdict or a settlement or a judgment out of their own funds, is exceedingly rare, particularly in a negligence case, because that's typically what's covered by your agency's malpractice insurance. We have really not encountered any cases of individual liability, out-of-pocket liability on the part of an EMS provider. Certainly where that provider commits some intentional act, assault or some act like that against a patient, their agency's insurance coverage would not cover those kinds of damages. But there probably isn't any insurance that somebody could get to cover an intentional act. That's really not what, you know, we want to encourage by selling insurance to go out and slug somebody. So, you know, generally as a matter of public policy, insurance doesn't cover that kind of stuff anyway. But when it comes to negligence, you know, we have not really seen cases where individual providers have had out-of-pocket liability. But, you know, the answer really is what assets does the individual have and, you know, want to protect? And, you know, that's really the case with any insurance. And, you know, the other thing to balance that out is that some of these individual liability policies, whether they're the standalone ones that you see advertised in GEMS and other magazines, or their riders or, you know, umbrella policies that get attached to your renter's insurance or to your homeowner's insurance, it's our experience that those aren't very much money, that those are not high-cost policies, that they're pretty reasonably priced. And, you know, for the extra peace of mind it provides, you know, for some providers, particularly if you have assets you'd like to protect, you know, those are policies that are certainly worth looking at and don't really cost all that much money.
Yeah, I think mine runs in the neighborhood of a couple hundred dollars a year, which I for the peace of mind, I think, and the fact that I own my own home and have other assets I'd like to protect, it seems to be worth it for me. But like you said, it's a personal decision I think each provider will need to make on those terms.
Right.
Now, if you do become involved in a situation where you as a provider are involved in some kind of a lawsuit, should you go out and seek your own representation, or should you rely on the representation that your company is already providing based for their own protection?
Well, that's a really good question. And, you know, what normally, just if I may for a second explain what happens in a malpractice lawsuit. And let's go back to the scenario that your agency or your organization has professional liability coverage. And normally what happens under that policy is if you and your organization or either one are sued in a malpractice suit, you have to give prompt notice to your insurance provider, and then they have a duty to hire legal counsel on your behalf and defend you in that lawsuit. And those legal costs would be part of your coverage. That would be something that your agency's insurance provider would do, is hire an attorney and pay that attorney to defend you in that case. Now, what many of our clients like to do is to engage us. Now, normally, if they get sued, that the insurance company will be the ones to appoint and hire the attorney on their behalf. And many times the agency or the person themselves, usually the agency, will hire their own attorney to sort of work hand in hand with the insurance company's attorney, the one that's hired by the insurance company, to sort of work together. And, you know, for example, when people engage us to do that, we work with their insurance attorneys to help them understand EMS, because sometimes, you know, they're general attorneys or defense attorneys who don't have specific background in this industry. We help them find expert witnesses. We help bring them up to speed on the EMS laws, the scope of practice for EMTs and paramedics, things that may have a bearing in the case, help identify and explain what the standard of care might be in a given clinical situation. And then we sort of help work with the insurance company's appointed attorney to help, oversee the case and make sure that if the case is going to be settled, that it's done within the policy limits of your coverage. And that way the claim is paid out of the proceeds of the insurance company's payment and not out of any payment or proceeds of the organization itself. So we sort of help keep the pressure on the insurance company's attorney to make sure the case is resolved within the policy limits, so that neither the agency or the individual are exposed to any of that individual or personal liability that might come out of their own pocket. If the case gets resolved within the limits of the insurance policy, then the insurance coverage is doing, you know, pretty much what it's supposed to be doing,
which right,
is protecting and indemnifying the agency and the individual. If there's a bad case, a case where a patient's paralyzed or a wrongful death case or something like that, it is conceivable that the damages or the verdict could exceed the policy limits. You know, if you have a $1 million per occurrence policy limit and the jury awards damages of $2 million, that extra million doesn't go away just because that's all the coverage you had. That extra $1 million of verdict would be, you know, the responsibility of the agency or the organization. So, you know, one of the things we would do as individual or personal counsel to the agency or to the person is to make sure that the case gets resolved within the insurance limits applicable to the case, so no one is exposed to that excess liability.
Okay, so the answer is then that it might be worth it for someone to seek just a personal counsel to make sure that focus is there and that it's somebody that understands EMS.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, what we would actually recommend is that if you're sued and your agency has coverage and your agency's insurance company provides an attorney and defends you in the case, to have your agency bear that cost of you know, looking after the case, hiring separate counsel for you and for your agency. And it really usually doesn't end up costing that much, because the insurance company's attorney is the one who normally does all the research, writes the briefs, goes to court, does the argument, does, you know, all of those procedural things. And we sort of work in a consultation role. So it usually keeps the cost down, which, of course, those costs would be borne by the agency itself. But it's usually a pretty good investment to help us help the agency keep their eyes on the insurance company.
Okay, excellent. Now, you're a provider, so you know that everybody gets that one chapter of EMS law and ethics in their EMTB or EMTP classes. But is there is there a need for us to really engage in that kind of continuing education on top of all of our airway and our pediatric and all the other medical training that we take? Is there a need for us to kind of continue on and maintain understanding of that process?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's as critical of skill as any of the, you know, clinical skills that we provide. You know, when you look at the evolution of things like do not resuscitate orders and patient refusals of care and, you know, dealing with minors and a lot of these very sticky legal situations that people get put into every day, you know, providers have to make choices, and those choices have consequences on the legal side, on the clinical side, and for a lot of other reasons. So if providers sort of don't stay up on that part of their practice, you know, they could face, you know, both legal and ethical situations that they're not prepared for. And, you know, dealing with patients who have DNR orders is a perfect example. The laws on that are evolving, they're changing, and providers really need to be up to speed on exactly what to do in those situations and, you know, be prepared to make those legal and sometimes ethical decisions.
Yeah, and I, you know, it's funny with the way the things go with the internet and things like YouTube and other places where you can post personal video and pictures. I wonder if, you know, I occasionally see ambulance responses recorded on somebody's camera phone posted up there, or accident scenes, and I wonder if people really understand that they might be putting themselves in a little bit of hot water by posting those kinds of that kind of information. Do you agree with that assessment, or?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there could very well be liability both for the agency and for the individual if they take a patient's protected, you know, personal health information and disclose that. And one of the things that we have really seen a wave of are cases where individuals have taken pictures of patients or of other identifying scenes with their individual cell phone cameras, and those pictures end up on web pages and in chat rooms and out on the internet. And you know, agencies and organizations really need to have very specific and strict policies. You know, our recommendation generally is that agencies not permit the use of cell phone cameras on duty whatsoever. You know, people can carry their cell phone. They may need that personally, but the policy should outright prohibit the use of cell phone cameras by individuals. And, you know, sometimes taking pictures on scenes does have a place, you know, to help document the mechanism of injury, to help document the scene if there's a potential crime scene, to help, you know, as long as photography doesn't delay patient care, it may certainly have a relevant place in EMS. However, just like completing a patient care report, when those photographs identify or could potentially identify a patient, they should be treated the same way as a patient care report. They should be owned by the agency. Those files, if they're, for example, a digital image, should only be on devices and cameras that are owned and issued by the agency. When those pictures are uploaded onto computers, they should be protected in the same way that the agency would protect the patient care report. They should be looked at as really part of the patient care report. And just because you took the picture, you have no more right to that picture as an individual than you do to the patient care report. That is a legal record of the agency, and the agency owns it, and the agency has the responsibility to oversee it, to make sure it's kept confidential and to make sure it's protected and not posted and not, you know, put on websites or distributed or sent to the media. Unless, of course, the patient specifically authorizes that to happen in writing, and that's the only time that that should happen.
I agree. We had just had a policy change in our company that there was to be no video recorded during while on any of the units, either during a response or during a routine transfer, and because apparently some of that material was appearing up on the internet. And while we don't think the unit was going too fast, it sure looked like it was, and that could be some pretty damning pictures to be out there on the internet were we to be involved in any kind of an incident.
Right.
Well, Doug, I want to thank you very much. I talked about continuing education a minute there, and I just wanted to give you an opportunity to talk a bit about your new video series on documentation. I was down at EMS today and talked with your business development person, I think Julie is her name, and we got a discount promo code for that for those two videos. We already use your HIPAA video in our company, and I'm looking forward to ordering these videos when they come out. But do you have anything to say about them? What kind of material is included in them? What they're about?
Oh, sure. Appreciate the opportunity to chat about that. We've just released a new video series on documentation called Write It Right. And there are two videos in the series. One is documenting for better billing, and the other is defensible documentation for EMS providers. And those two videos together provide a sort of a comprehensive training program for EMS provider documentation. The better billing video is geared toward ambulance services that bill Medicare and other payers for their services. And that video gets into documenting medical necessity, documenting bed confined status, documenting emergencies and non-emergencies, and the reimbursement issues that go along with that. The other video, the defensible EMS documentation video, is for anybody that provides EMS, whether they're in a fire department, whether they transport, whether they don't transport. And that covers a lot of the clinical and operational situations like patient refusals, dealing with minors, charting formats like the chart and the SOAP format, the operational issues, documenting DNR patients. And that really gets into a lot of the day-to-day nitty-gritty and provides a lot of case examples, actual court case studies where documentation was an issue. And there are, with both of those DVDs, there's a CD of instructional materials that has sample patient care reports, that has instructor handouts, that has continuing education information in them. And the video series is nationally accredited for continuing education credits. So not only can people watch them and, you know, get valuable information on documentation, but they can also earn continuing education credits for doing it. And the information is contained on those CDs as well. So it's something we're proud of. We've worked on for a long time, and we're very happy and pretty excited to be coming out with it. And we're getting a very good response to it in the industry, and a lot of orders for it already. And it seems to really be filling a need in the market. So we're happy to have gotten this out.
Well, I think that documentation is really one of those holes in any provider's bag of tricks. If there is something that somebody isn't good at, it's documentation. And just, I think we all could stand to improve the way we do that, whether we've been doing this for 20 years or for 2 months. It really is something that can always be improved upon. And I'm looking forward to getting my hands on that, Doug. So I appreciate you talking with me today, and I'd like to offer the opportunity to welcome you back. If a topic ever comes up that you think you might like to share with my listeners, please get back in touch with me. I'd love to have you back on, and we can talk about legal issues with EMS anytime that you would care to.
Well, I appreciate the invitation, and I'm sure there'll be more to talk about in the future, and I look forward to coming back.
And there will be links to the DVD set in the show notes for that documentation series, as well as a listing of the promo codes, both in the show notes and a link to the page, blog post page I put up about a month ago with more information on how to get those DVDs. So you can head on over to www.medicast.com to get more information on how to save some money if your agency is interested in picking up those documentation training series. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the Medicast. I want to thank Doug Wolfberg again for sharing his time and expertise with us here at the Medicast. Head on over to the links in the show notes, and you can find out a little bit more about what Paige Wolfberg and Worth does for EMS providers and the services and training materials that they provide over at their website. Of course, I want to thank all of you, the listeners, for supporting the program in all of the ways that you do, by visiting the links on the website page, supporting the advertisers there, listening to the show and sharing the podcast with everybody that you know. Letting people know about the Medicast by word of mouth is one of the best ways to help out the show. Let people know what's going on. As always, if you'd like to get in touch with me, you can reach me here at the Medicast at podmedic@mac.com, or you can call me on the voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. I'll wrap up, as I always do, with some really great PodSafe music. And this song comes from a band by the name of Break Lazy. Break Lazy was kind enough to send in their own intro to the song and a special message for the Medicast listeners, a message for EMS providers to just say thanks. And I really appreciated Mackie and Jordan and the other members of Break Lazy over there who sent over this as well as copies of their music. I will have copies of their CD the next time I have a giveaway here. So that's another incentive for you to sign up for the newsletter. Because I use the newsletter list as a way to handle the giveaways of things on this show. And a lucky newsletter winner won the VeinLight EMS back in January when I gave it away. So it's an opportunity for you to have access to that. So I'm going to wrap up here with the song Tricks from Break Lazy. Tricks and tricks of the trade are what we're all about here at the Medicast, helping everybody learn the little things that we can take in the field and make our patient care plan a little bit better. Until next time, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Scene safety, BSI.
Hey, this is Mackie. I'm from a rock band called Break Lazy, and I'm here to thank you guys for being there for us, for going out there every day, bringing the immediate medical attention to people like us when we really need it. You're the rescuers of our time, man, and we appreciate it. And to show our thanks, we're going to send you guys off with a tune of ours called Tricks. It's off our new album called The Wasteland. I hope you guys enjoy it, and I hope I don't see you too soon. But if I do, I know I'll be safe. Thanks a lot, guys.
You got some tricks up your sleeve. I think you think I know that. Whoa. A magic spell stands back, what you think, and mutual lust, a fraction of attraction. Whoa. But we bite our tongues and go on thinking, would I fall if you got down? Whoa, let but we bite our tongues and go.